Welcome to What If, So What, the podcast where we ask what's possible with digital and figure out how to make it real in your business. I'm Jim Hertzfeld.
And I'm Kim Chopek. We're part of Perficient's digital strategy team, and today we'll ask what if, so what, and most importantly, now what?
One of my all-time favorite quotes, and I am a quote collector, is from author Stuart Brand, who said, "Once a new technology rolls over you, if you're not part of the steamroller, you're part of the road." And it's a powerful statement because, first of all, it's very visual. Nobody wants to see themselves flattened on the road. But, you know, there really is a lot of anxiety and FOMO associated with new technology because it is exciting and new and different, and everyone wants to cash in, and people want first mover advantage, and there's a lot of stories and excitement about other technology launches, right? So the reality, though, here, there's a little bit of misdirection. Once technology is established and it crosses the chasm, it's a reference to a great book you should check out, you don't want to be left behind. But not every technology makes it. Not every technology makes sense for you. And that's one of the reasons why innovation is hard. Andy Hunt is manager of Digital Innovation Lab at the Hershey Company, a brand we spent a lot of time with as a kid. With an engineering background, he has nearly two decades of leading teams to inventive solutions that blend art, imagination, and code. And using broad conceptual and strategic thinking, which makes it really exciting for us, he's a passionate believer in the thoughtful application of technology to solve problems for Hershey. Hey, welcome to the podcast, Andy.
Hi, Jim. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, great for you to join us. Really looking forward to this conversation. Kim and I have been talking about it quite a bit since we first met you guys. That's just for the audience and maybe just to kind of get it going today. Just in your own words, what's a day in the life for you and your team? Tell us a little bit more about your role and what your team does for Hershey.
Sure. Thanks again for having me. It's just a pleasure to be here with you this morning. My name is Andy Hunt. I'm a manager in the Applied Digital Innovation Group within the digital commerce team at the Hershey Company. A typical day in the life for myself or one of my teammates is usually involved working with a business partner in some capacity to take a look at a technology with the idea that we are going to solve a particular problem that the business might have today or is forecast out to need to address at some point in the future. It's really, really interesting because we get to work across the business, both in terms of looking at some near-term stuff that might be 6 to 12 months out, as well as looking at some longer-term things, maybe 48 months to 5 years out, all with the goal, again, of developing some interesting ideas against a particular problem that the business might wind up having. And we can do that for an internally focused problem or something more externally that one of our consumers or customers might be facing.
So there are a few words in sort of our industry vocabulary that I love and I hate. And I'll be honest, innovation innovation is one of my, it's funny, ironically, digital is one, strategy is one. Innovation is another. They just have so many meanings. And so much potential. And I think practitioners kind of get it. But I think you may have kind of answered this question, but what is innovation? Is it just something different? Is it just a new idea? Is it something, you know, some sort of breakthrough, a disruption? You know, all these things kind of get tossed around. From your perspective, the word innovation, can you just kind of ground that for us a little bit? How do you describe that?
Sure. And I completely empathize. Innovation does tend to be a white noise word because everybody does throw that around quite a bit. So I completely understand what you're coming from. The way that I approach innovation and we take a look at innovation is the idea that you're looking at a new idea or a solution to a problem that delivers at scale to its audience. And that's a pretty pithy and short description there. There's a lot to unpack there. What it basically means is a new solution. Again, it's going to deliver to a lot of people that are interested in that particular solution. I used to use a descriptor of creative in terms of what the solution needed to be, but that tends to narrow the definition just a bit, and it leaves a lot to interpretation for how an individual would define what creative really is. But it's a new idea that you can deliver to people. You know, in the space that we operate in, we tend to do, you know, a lot of experimentation, a lot of, you know, bench work, if you will, and we have a lot of very interesting ideas, but it's not really innovative until we can show it off to people and then figure out how to scale it so that it actually applies to real world problems in a large, meaningful type of way.
You kind of repeated sort of what I found interesting in your role there, which is this joining of problem and solution. And you know, the idea that there's, I don't know who said this, but a leader without followers is just a person on a walk, you know, an idea without a use. It's just an idea, right? It has to go forward. It has to provide value. It has to scale. All those things make it more than just a creative idea.
Yeah, I really used to like to consider that that characterization of calling it a creative idea, but that again tended to limit it to what somebody's perception of what creative might wind up being. What I find creative is not necessarily what you and others might find creative, but it really is an idea that that has to demonstrate value at scale.
Right. You know, one of the things too about, I run into this with clients a lot, where they don't seem to have a shortage of ideas. What they struggle with is converting those ideas into reality, and sometimes that involves sort of narrowing it down. So if I had 100 ideas, there are probably 20 that are viable, 10 that will get considered, 5 that will get funded, 2 or 3 that are actually going to work and scale. Right? My ratios might be wrong. I hope the odds are better than that. But you know, sometimes it feels like there's just no shortage, or we're inundated.
Your mileage might vary.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I hope your mileage is better. But of course, you know, we could go off. Well, I'll follow up on this. You know, there's always something to learn, even from the failures. But how do you separate the good ideas from the great ideas?
That really involves a tight as possible relationship with our business partners, our internal business partners, to really develop against those. Because we, as I mentioned, we aren't really assigned or organized within one particular vertical function within the organization, we have that freedom to work across the business. So it's finding those business partners who are interested in an idea that we have, who can help us divine out what that idea might actually mean in terms of a real value, again, at scale to solving a problem that they've got. As with a lot of organizations that take a look at innovation, or there's an idea of the funnel. And the funnel is very large and broad to start when we're looking at things. And then as we get closer and closer to making that idea reality, those ideas tend to winnow down. And the application against those ideas tend to get winnowed down to the applied part of where our name is. We apply them towards a real issue. You know, we might wind up starting with, to your point, and to the idea that your mileage may vary, you know, 100, 150 ideas at the start of a year, to that when we winnow it down to finding the right business partners against which to apply those ideas, might wind up going forward with 25 or 30 projects. And then as the year progresses, we might actually develop 10, 15 proof of concepts or pilots in which to really prove out those ideas. Really working tightly with our internal business partners to understand what are the ideas to chase.
Well, it's sort of this loop. I know that, I think in the traditional sort of systems thinking, we'll call it project management world, where, you know, the business would define a problem, charter a project, generate requirements, then the innovators go out and invent something or make it work. Very linear, very kind of one way, sort of top down. In some ways, you know, the innovation world is, let's generate creative solutions. And then in a way, we kind of move from bottom up and find the best applications. But I think what you're saying is it's really a partnership, because you're not just randomly generating ideas, right? You certainly have, you know, the larger sort of vision, you know, or strategic picture in mind. And then you find a way to sort of make them work together. I always use the tunnel metaphor, right? We started digging the tunnel in England, the other end in France, and we met in the middle. Is that a sort of accurate depiction of the partnership?
That is a bit. And we have a bit of a mandate here at the first step in our process is called curation. And that does involve some of that more open-ended blue sky thinking and consideration for technologies and ideas to pursue that may not be as tightly integrated to an understood business need or an understood business strategy, but it comes with an intrinsically understood understanding of how something could be used against one of those business strategies, and being able to make the logical connection points to bring that into the business and make a positive, quote unquote, selling case into the business to why this is something worth pursuing and how it could be applied. The other interesting thing to remember with some of these things is that some of these ideas, they never really die. Just because you might be moving through the funnel at one end somewhere in the middle, you decide that you're not going to pursue an idea any further, that doesn't mean you're never going to see it again. There are plenty of examples where, you know, we might have parked an idea or parked a project to let it sit because We had to kill it because the technology wasn't right, the business wasn't right, just the idea wasn't the idea upon which it was going to be built just wasn't as no pun intended as baked as it could have been. So we'll park it and come back to it, and then when the time is right. So when we're going through ideas, we never really say that we're not going to pursue this. It's always a matter of we're not going to pursue this now, and then if we're really able to, we'll say, okay, we're not going to pursue this now, but in 6 months, we need to revisit this and we'll come back and take another look at it. And there's been a couple of instances where we've taken a broad sort of categorization look at a suite of technologies, maybe, and it hasn't applied here, but because we've learned more about that, the technology or the idea, and in this singular application that does maybe have some application to somewhere else. And so while we might not pursue it here, we've learned a lot more about it, which gives us a better position to pursue it in another part of the business.
Is there sort of a law of unintended consequences there as well? I mean, sometimes you dig in, you think, well, this is not what I thought it was, but could have an application over here. So
absolutely.
Let's hold off until they're ready. Yeah. Yeah. I love that part of the process. You know, not to mention that you can't do it all, right? I think that's why that decisioning and that selection criteria and kind of getting through the funnel is so important.
Yeah, you're exactly right. It's just a group of us, a small group of us looking into these things. We absolutely can't do it all, but it's a matter of finding those elements which we can identify a priority against that has a value calculation of some capacity, both in the immediate or in the long term, against which that we can go ahead and proceed.
So it sounds like you've got some pretty good buy-in and you've made some great progress. And it sounds like I'll just speak candidly and, you know, with regard to a lot of other organizations who are just trying to drive out the goal and satisfy the shareholders. What was sort of the secret to get the organization to buy into that? Could, you know, and there's a level of sort of change management involved in that as well. What do you think worked really well for Hershey in pulling this off?
I think it goes into a lot about how we build relationships with our partners in the business and how we genuinely try to empathize with the solutions and the conditions under which they are operating. You know, Hershey's is a fairly large organization, but there are plenty of opportunities to meet and interact with a lot of different people. And, you know, I happen to work out of, you know, 19 East, which is considered our home office, and we have a lot of various locations. So whenever I'm talking with folks, I never try to position myself as that this idea that we're working on, and, you know, we want to consider that this is an idea or a technology that's coming down from corporate type of thing. I never try to, you know, inflict, if you will, my ideas or my opinions on anybody. And I want to make sure that I do the best that I can to communicate that I'm from corporate, but I'm there to help. There are the practical matters of, you know, putting up budget and other resources that it comes with to putting into projects to say, look, you know, I to demonstrate that I'm an equal partner in this, you know, I'm willing to devote certain amount of resources to this to help us all bring this idea to life. I've been very, very fortunate in that somehow, despite the past 14 months of this new operating model that we're all dealing with, I've made some phenomenal connections into the business and to really understand how some of my colleagues in supply chain, or how some of my colleagues in engineering, or some of my colleagues in merchandising are working and the problems that they're trying to face, so that I can then take that back to, quote unquote, the lab and help try to solve those problems for them.
That's interesting. That's a neat twist. It's sort of like maybe the remote model has sort of flattened the organization in some way and allowed you to make those direct connections. Is that part of it?
Yeah. I think it really might have. I can't say that it wouldn't have been done prior to, but I think it maybe, because we've, you know, had to be home for a while, you maybe make that extra effort, conscious or otherwise, to really go out and try to make those connections with other folks, and it's worked phenomenally well, I think, for at least myself. Again, in terms of, you know, reaching out to other parts of the business and hey, I was talking to so and so, and I heard so and so, and stepping up and trying to say, hey, look, we're looking at this, and we think this could help you here, and you want to be a partner in this with us.
That's interesting, because you use the word empathize, and I think we use that word often to correlate to our end consumers and prospects and customers. So we talk about building a product or service, you know, to meet the needs of our customers and make their lives easier. But that applies, I think, in this role as much, if not more, to building empathy for the organization first, right? And sort of what I'm hearing is really building the right culture, you know, having the top-down leadership and support. But I'm also kind of hearing that there's a bit of a show and tell and improve it element to that. I see that a lot. So it's a lot of dimensions to making that work.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I'm probably sickeningly apologetic when I'm meeting, especially with meeting the new folks in the business, in terms of, you know, saying that look, the questions that I ask are coming from a place of ignorance, not challenge. I'm genuinely trying to learn the problems that you're trying to face. And I have to continually and consciously engage from a place of not knowing as much as I think I do about the problems that my colleagues are trying to face, or the solutions that they may already have considered.
That's interesting because, yeah, you have to sort of simultaneously be the person who's trying to learn and but also the person that has all the answers.
Well, no, I have a lot of answers. I don't know if I have the answers.
Okay. There you go. The answer. We're back to, more ideas than we can handle. So, yeah. Now that's an interesting, you know, I think that's a unique position though, that I think innovation teams have though, right? Because there is I think there maybe is an expectation from your internal stakeholders that, hey, Andy's coming here to make, he's got the answer. He's got the solution. You know, we're Apollo 13 and he's on the ground trying to figure out how the command module is going to work.
That's a really good analogy. I do get that a lot. And I love the enthusiasm that people generally tend to have when we're talking with them about trying to help. I think it's, there's a few things going on. It's because people are a getting attention to solve a problem they're trying to face, and who doesn't like getting them a little bit of extra attention on that? Hmm. B, they're getting a little bit of extra opportunity to talk about themselves, and by and large, who doesn't like talking about themselves? and for the most part, and I think it's just a matter then of giving people a space and an opportunity to talk about the things that they're trying to solve and generally listen and try to help.
I love that. Listening is just an underrated skill. I found that too. Like somebody says, finally somebody is willing to listen to my point of view.
It is a skill. It is a skill that you've got to really try to consider and be conscious of. As you've been through probably, hundreds, if not thousands upon tens of thousands of conversations where you've had, where just literally talking something through gives somebody the ability to, uncover some new ground there that they hadn't considered for something else. And then if you're able to, just ask the right questions to get somebody to maybe think about something and be able to verbalize that idea and maybe just a different way they hadn't considered, then maybe you're going to be onto something and be able to really provide some real help to somebody.
I think it's an important design principle. I think of other core designers that I know, sort of their process is, hey, look, we're going to uncover stuff until we find the answer, which is different than, we're going to explore deep space, until we find this find the answer. I'm on a science fiction kick today. I don't know what's going on. We'll stick with the deep space.
Quite all right. There's a lot of exciting things going on with SpaceX right now.
Well, speaking of experimentation, I had a couple kind of burning questions for you. One I love is I want to know what your favorite failure was, and I think that's failure. And I think in innovation circles and design circles, it really is about the value of experimentation. What did we learn when something, didn't quite go the way we expected? Do you have a sort of a failure in mind or a lesson that you think surprised you or helped something turn the corner?
Yeah, I think probably my favorite failure, excuse me, at least from recent memory, was from a prior career, if you will, when I was in advertising, and I helped design a booth experience for an HVAC equipment manufacturer. And they were coming out with a new model of piece of equipment that used magnetics as a central component, a central tenet of the value proposition for this piece of equipment. And I had the bright idea to use magnets and levitation to levitate a scale model of this piece of equipment in the booth. So there would be a display that would be using magnets and, again, levitation, the scale model, which was, it was scaled down to about 2 feet by, I think, about a foot by about a foot and a half tall, that would be levitating above this table, which I thought was going to make for a show-stopping, incredibly engaging, hugely conversational display experience. And we got it executed, and it was pretty amazing to take a look at this and see this again, see this model levitating a few inches off of the table. Because, it was a show-stopping, but it was an interesting conversation point to say, how are you doing that? And then you can make that transition point into, well, we're using magnets. And, oh, by the way, this new piece of equipment uses magnets. So it felt like to me that it was the perfect display vehicle through which to not only create something stopping for the visitor, but actually tells you that story then of the product itself. And I won't say that it fell flat, but it certainly fell flatter to what I was expecting. I had expected, my naive, perhaps, enthusiasm, expected crowds, expected conversations. I expected, think pieces about about this thing. And it was
cover of Life magazine.
Exactly. And it was well received. I mean, because it went into production, of course, the client understood, the client got it, the client expected it, was excited about it, but it didn't get the sort of level of buzz that I was thinking. And so I think it speaks a bit to tempering my expectations and the idea, at least in terms of the way that I need to proceed, again, goes back to making sure that my expectations, I guess, or what I would perceive as, well, something should be perceived.
Yeah.
Needs to be set accordingly. Because the audience, perhaps at this show, maybe did not care so much about levitation. It did not care so much about it and wanted to hear more about the actual functions directly of this particular piece of unit. So that, I think, is probably my biggest, at least from recent term, from biggest failure.
Yeah, magnets are, I guess, they're either going to be they're going to attract a lot of people or they're going to repel a lot of people. So that's
shame on you. Shame on you.
And that joke just failed as well.
Shame on you. that speaks directly to the creative part of me, especially when I was working in a very explicitly creative field. The idea of what one people might find, extremely creative. It again goes back to the earlier idea is that not everybody is going to find something extremely creative.
There's some risk taking there, which is an element as well. Last question here I had for you, another one when I really we were speaking about this a few weeks ago. You use a word that I've incorporated in my vocabulary ever since, and that's about making things durable. It's a word I don't hear a lot. And, you hear scalable, you hear, we can scale it, we can monetize it, we can convert it. But the idea of durability, help us understand. That's a word I think people need to start to think about more extensively. But tell us a little bit about what you mean by making things durable.
Yeah, I wish I could give credit where I first heard that phrase. It was fairly recently. But I've become enamored with that phrase as well. And I'm sure that at some point in the future, it's going to become white noise, just like the phrase maybe innovation or digital will be. But for now, I'm going to use it lovingly. It resonates with me because it speaks to the idea that something will be extremely long lasting and effective in its design use case, no matter what comes. A durability, to me, tells me that something is self-sustaining and doesn't need constant supervision. And it can... Not to be too poetic or dramatic, but it can withstand an onslaught of conditions which may either be implicitly or explicitly at odds with it. There's this implicit strength in something that isn't apparent that may allow it to stand up and be long-lasting and be valuable and durable for a long time. Not to be too redundant there in the idea, but I think durability can provide a level of surprise. When that implicit strength manifests itself, you take a look at something and you consider, I didn't know that this idea could do that, and it still works. That must mean it's a pretty good idea, and it implies some durability. I think for myself, you might talk about a sustainable idea, and I think durability perhaps is the next evolution in what you might have been what someone might consider as a sustainable idea. What makes a nice transition from sustainable and durable is the idea that sustainability has other, you know, sort of ESG types of parameters around that definition, whereas with durability, I think has a more wide span of application in terms of where that term could be, where that term could be applied.
Right. Yeah, I hear the word, you know, another key word that's kind of popped up a lot in the last year is resilience, you know, but, my mental model was I think of people as resilient. And I think of ideas and products as durable. So.
Yeah. Durability feels like to me, has a certain strength to it and a bend, don't break sort of strength to it. And resiliency has a nice connotations that it can withstand a lot of beatings and keep on ticking, to use an old ad phrase.
Right. That is a good one. All right. Well, we're just about out of time here, Andy. I want to thank you for coming on the podcast and giving us your perspective. I feel like you've seen all the angles. I appreciate you sharing them with us today. It's a great perspective.
I appreciate you having me and taking the time, and I hope I've provided some level of value to yourself and your listeners.
Certainly have. Thanks, Andy.
Thank you very much, Jim.
So I'm back here with Kim. Kim, big question for you. What are you innovating on?
You know, after talking with Andy, I'm not sure I'm innovating on anything. I really liked his thought that interesting isn't innovating. It really resonated with me and made me stop and think about what I've been calling innovation in the past. For example, is a new feature on an existing product really an innovation? I think it could be potentially if there was a lot of customer demand for it and it offered a brand new value proposition. But in most cases, I think it's not. It's just a new feature, something interesting. I'm starting to think an innovation really needs a new definition. It needs to address a gap in the market in a way that no one has thought of before. Perhaps. I'm reminded, for example, of jobs to be done theory. And really getting to the root of customer needs. And Andy's story about his memorable failure sort of illustrated that. If you don't do the legwork to understand what kind of value proposition will resonate with your target customers, how can you really innovate?
Yeah, I think this is going to come back to some other themes that have come up in other episodes. You know, innovation is like other sort of ambiguous words, but I like his word, a white noise word. I hadn't heard that before, but it evolves, right? So strategy, digital, innovation, are these white noise? Well, how do we make them real, right? I mean, again, that's the whole theme here. But I just love that idea that it is changing, right? The definition can change. The approach can change. Can I say this? We can actually innovate on innovating? That sounds a little circular, but I think there's some truth there. You know, I think a couple other things I really took away. Another one is that creative is not the same to everyone. Sort of a beauty is in the eye of the beholder. But
yes,
you know, that is a little intangible. I think that's maybe a topic to explore in another episode as I hear myself talk about it. But the other thing I really like and that people should continue to take solace in, I guess, is that this funnel of ideas, they never die, right? They're you learn. Sometimes the ideas are not right for the time. They have to come back. Sometimes they have to be adapted and reborn. What are other things like that? The best thing I could come up with is music and the Bob Dylan basement tapes. Like, how do you find, you know, old songs you wrote and perform them in a new way? I mean, you know, for the time. So that's a whole area to explore. And I think he kind of shed a lot of light on that angle of innovation, because I think that's lost. But the biggest thing that I really enjoyed about it is this idea of culture. And we hear about so much about this all the time, culture and leadership. And he said, you know, I don't want to be the guy from corporate who comes out to inflict my idea on you. And again, I think that all comes back to having good empathy. I think, Kim, that takes us to our what if. This is our namesake segment to the show. I have a couple what ifs. I know you've got a so what. We'll get to the now what. I had a kind of a list of things. It's just, again, it's touched on so many things I've seen in my career, but put yourself in the shoes of a business stakeholder, you know, and you hear about innovation, you know, there's a lot of hope, right? There's a lot of, you don't know what the answer is, right? But what if you could take any problem, whether it's a business improvement, right? Changing a business model or responding to some competitive threat, or fix something that keeps breaking, or just making something more efficient, you know, so you don't have to repeat the same fixes over and over again? What if you could buy a solution? I think that's what a lot of business stakeholders want. That's sort of the promise of innovation. I've got this problem. Can I just write a check?
Like a silver bullet.
Yes,
right?
It is. Yeah, yeah, exactly it. The silver bullet theory, the easy button.
Yeah.
You know, if I write a check, you know, if I spend enough money, it'll go away. I heard this categorized as airline magazine problems. I think we had an executive once that if their leaders would go on a trip, then they would come back. They would pick something up in an airline magazine, some business article highly targeted for an executive, and they'd say, I need this, right? And so, well, it's not that easy, right? There aren't easy buttons. So I think that's where innovation comes back in. Like if it was easy, it would be done already. You know, we work with a consultant who said, you know, like if I've done this before, it wouldn't be an innovation for you.
Right.
So can you send it somewhere and it's done? I mean, I think that's, to me, that's sort of the big what if for innovation is, can I, if I can't just buy it, if I can't write a check, not that there isn't spend, not that there isn't energy, but how do I do that? That's really the what if. What if I had a place to go that isn't just building a mobile app, right? If it isn't just making a change, but it's really a meaningful investment. You know, so what, Kim? So what would that mean to you?
Yeah, well, I think I just keep going back to, I think organizations really need to rally around what their definition of innovation is to understand if they've really innovated or they've simply just extended a product or a value proposition. Andy talked about the word durable as guidance, which I thought was really thought-provoking. To be innovative, something should withstand a series of expected and unexpected uses, events, so on and so forth, implicit and explicit challenges, so on and so forth. But it might be the case that innovation can only be arrived at in hindsight. But I do think, you know, this notion of durable is a good product design principle. And I also would just keep coming back to what you mentioned earlier, experimentation and customer research. There is no silver bullet. And if we really are looking for innovative solutions, it starts with understanding your customer. And we've seen that over and over again.
I wanted a really innovative now what for this episode, but it does come back to that. It's funny. Hindsight is 2020. You know, I was going to invoke sort of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. Like when you observe something, you change it, but there's no crystal ball, but it does come back to, yeah, understanding empathy, you know, understanding where you stand, understanding how that's going to influence the decisions you make. Cause I've often thought that there is no shortage of ideas. You know, it's just picking the right ones, and the right ones are the ones that are going to satisfy the customer needs. So, and Kim, I think you agree. We see this a lot. This is a miss. We see so many projects. We're associated with one right now with a big brand, and they want to do something really cool. And it took a lot of work to get to convince them to engage their users. I think they're really glad that they did.
Yeah.
I think we just have to keep going back to that, you know, build real empathy.
Totally agree.
All right, Kim, I think that does it for us. So until next time, keep asking what if, so what, and now what?
You've been listening to What If, So What, the digital strategy podcast from Perficient with Jim Hertzfeld and Kim Chopek. We want to thank our Perficient colleagues, JD Norman and Rick Bauer, for our music today. Subscribe to the podcast and don't miss a single episode. You can find this season along with show notes at Perficient.com. Thanks for listening.